Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on Human Services. This is Monday, February 8th. We are going to adjust the agenda because of members' participation in other hearings and other meetings. We're going to reverse the order. We're going to start with a work session on Oregon Health Authority. So if any of you needed to maybe leave the room for a few minutes and come back later, we're doing OHA first. So I'm convening a work session, Oregon Health Authority Investments in Mental Health and Addiction Services Report.
Madam Co-Chair, while the agency's coming up, so the Oregon Health Authority received some funding for community mental health and addiction services, and there was a budget note requiring them to report on activities related to that funding, and that's what they're there to do this morning.
Thank you.
I don't know.
Okay.
Good morning. Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, my name is Karen Wheeler, and I'm the Business and Operational Policy Director for the Oregon Health Authority Health Systems Division. And I'm here today to provide a report on the implementation of the new mental health and substance use disorder investments that pertain to the 2015-17 legislatively adopted budget. The written report in a letter format was also sent to you in writing, so you should have that in front of you. The investments include $22 million in new community mental health services and $6 million in new substance use disorder services. We completed a competitive solicitation for rental assistance, and we've committed funding for all of the 15 projects that submitted proposals for those funds. That will purchase an additional 400 slots in rental assistance, adding to the investment from last session or the 2013 session. That will be a total of just over 900 slots for rental assistance in the state of Oregon. We used fair market rent values. We researched those prior to putting out the solicitation. So there's regional differences in rents, and so those were used to fund the 400 slots. We contracted with the Oregon Health and Science University for the Opal K funds of $1.5 million. So that contract is complete. We also changed the clinical portion of the adult residential alcohol and drug treatment rates. We adjusted those rates from $85.50 to $100 for the clinical portion of the rate, and that is excluding the room and board portion of that rate. So that's an add-on to the rate. So those were adjusted for both the Medicaid fee-for-service program and the non-Medicaid clinical program for people that are not on Medicaid. We distributed $500,000 to Josephine County in October of 2015. The county, in partnership with Choices Counseling Center in Grants Pass, broke ground on the new facility in October, and plans are on target to have an operating sobering facility earlier this year. So that is exciting to many people there, and it's also exciting to us. Unfortunately, the mass shooting incident in Umpqua Community College in Roseburg has caused some delays in working with that community to get those funds into play. We're still working with leaders down there to make sure that that happens. So I can report on that later if you'd like, but we're still working on that. A competitive solicitation worth $250 will hit the Oregon procurement system today for the remaining $1,000.
Thank you. That was the word that was missing. Thank you.
It's Monday morning. Super Bowl was yesterday. So that solicitation will hit ORPIN today and will be available to one or more facilities that want to establish a sobering facility in Oregon. It could be an existing facility or a new facility.
Can I? My apologies, Chair. I had a list of questions I wanted to ask, and I'm being summoned to one of my priority bills is now up right now in another committee. I just wanted to clarify, based on your last statement of the remaining funds, at some point we can dialogue more on how we went from $6 million all the way down to $1 million for these centers. But one of my concerns on your last statement about the $250,000 and the competitive process, I'm concerned about how long it's taking to get that out there. based on the report, it's going to be May, and that's, I mean, almost a year after we approved it. And the other thing I wanted to clarify, based on your last statement, are those funds intended for only new facilities or existing facilities? Can both apply to that?
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, Representative Stark, the $250,000, and we sought some information from leadership before we put together the RFP, is for both new and existing facilities.
Thank you.
And the breakdown of the $6 million, a piece of that, a good chunk of that, was the rate increase for residential. It was $3.5 million, mm-hmm. which was directed by leadership here. And then there's a peer-delivered services investment, which I'll talk about in a minute, that is $1.5 million. So that's the breakdown of the $6
million. Thank you. And unfortunately, I will I will watch this later. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Competitive solicitations for both jail diversion and crisis intervention services were posted to ORPIN in December of 2015, and those proposals are due this week, February 9th and 10th, respectively. We sought technical assistance from the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration Gaines Center on criminal justice and behavioral health before we put that RFP together again. We used the basic framework from the RFP that we conducted in 2013, but we wanted to improve upon that and make sure that there was a link and a connection between law enforcement and behavioral health that was very specifically stated in the RFP. So we got some great help from the federal government in doing that, put together a new RFP, and it, as I said, we will be receiving proposals this week. The addictions peer-delivered services solicitation is in the final stages of development. We're just now working on the final questions with the Department of Justice on that for legal sufficiency. That we anticipate that to hit today or in the next couple of days on ORPIN. And this is a $1.5 million investment to help establish regional centers of excellence and provide peer-delivered services as well, so that we can really get this service solid and ramped up around the state. This is a service that we talked a lot about during the Ways and Means presentation, and it's something that really helps people to achieve recovery, sustain recovery. It's not treatment. But it really helps people take that next step and be solid in their recovery. So that, we're excited about that, and it should hit any day now. So I think I've covered all the investments. I want to thank you for the opportunity to provide this input and this update, and for your interest in hearing about this.
Yes. Thank you. Senator Duffy.
I'm the latest addition to this committee. Just had two questions, Madam Chair. One, on the $7 million approximately that went to rental assistance.
That's what I heard.
The math on that is about 17,000 plus per case. The language here, speaking of that, is helping with transitioning for people and from various facilities and individuals that are homeless. Is this intended to be, in essence, transitional housing for them, or is this like a permanent subsidy?
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, Senator Dublin, rental assistance can be more of a sustained or long-term placement for an individual, so it is not necessarily transitional housing. However, when a person achieves recovery, starts getting engaged in the community, goes through supported employment, or is really interested in taking the next step, they can move out of that placement and go somewhere else. But it is more of a long-term placement.
Okay. Let's follow up.
Yes.
The budget note that you're complying with, and I know it might be difficult for some of these, and it would depend upon the baseline data that you have and the ability to evaluate that over time, but there's very little in this report that speaks to outcomes. It speaks more to outputs, how many cases you're going to cover, how much you're going to increase the rate. Very little as far as outcomes. In the future, when we put in place budget notes for outcomes, this is a broader question. I think in many cases the agency lacks baseline data to determine what the impact is of investments in this area. Was there any discussion about how you would reflect true outcomes with this report rather than just merely the output from these investments?
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, Senator Devlin, I would be happy to come back at some point after these investments have been implemented for a period of time. As you know, some of the investments are additional funding for the same type of programs that were funded in the 2013-15 biennium. And I did come to the legislature and provided a report for those funds as well. I can send you that if you'd like. We are collecting reports from all the contractors to get a sense about not only how many people they're serving, but what kind of outcomes they're getting in their communities. We do have some data systems that are also capturing some information that relate to outcomes specifically. And as you may have heard, we are putting together a tool to help us map outcomes as well as services and the kinds of issues that face communities around behavioral health. So there's a collection of data that we're putting together in a more targeted and strategic way that will help us to look at outcomes and help you all as well. So yes, this report is just more about how we've been implementing the money and getting the funding out.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Two quick questions, if I could. The first is, and this may seem counterintuitive in some ways, historically, I think, when we've been working with people struggling with addictions and who have been homeless, the prerequisite for them going into housing has been sobriety and maintaining sobriety, generally speaking, in some instances. I've been working closely with some colleagues in Utah where they're trying hard to address their homelessness problem. Their situation's a little different than ours, so I don't want to compare completely apples to oranges, but there are some interesting things that they're doing, not least of which is not requiring sobriety for placement in housing. And I find that an interesting concept because I think it's very hard to get sober if you're on the streets. And I recognize that, and I think it's pretty easy to have small relapses when you're on the road to permanent sobriety. And that's why we always call people with addictions in recovery, right? And need to support them through that. So I wondered whether you all are starting to think about alternative models where there's a different kind of supported housing for people who are not yet sober and who are not yet prepared to commit to being fully sober and don't want to risk losing their housing because of a relapse, and therefore, if they relapse, may not be willing to seek the help that they need to turn back on the path to sobriety.
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, Senator Steiner Hayward. Yes. The quick answer is yes. And I'm so glad to hear you say the things that you just said about recovery and addiction. It is a chronic disease. It's not like somebody can just decide to stop and stop, especially if they have challenges and are not, you know, don't have a home. So absolutely, yes, we're looking at different models. I would like to lead efforts so that we have a variety of kinds of models, not only Oxford houses, but other kinds of, you know, housing first models.
Right. And if I may, Madam Chair, quickly. The other question I have, speaking of diversion, and it may be in your full report, which I haven't read, but the part about diversion out of the criminal justice system, how closely are you all working with the new Unity project in the metro area? Because that strikes me as having real potential for diversion, both from traditional emergency departments, which is not really the right place for people in mental health crisis to get care, and from the criminal justice system for very petty people with petty crimes committed in the throes of mental health crisis.
Absolutely. Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, Senator Steiner Hayward, we are working very closely with the Unity Project. In fact, just last week I was on a phone call with them, so there's very close coordination with that project.
Great, thank you. I look forward to hearing more about that.
My question for you is related to peer-delivered services. In the letter, the first sentence explains, the agency is conducting competitive solicitation for infrastructure projects in order to build regional capacity for these services.
I'd like to understand more about what you mean by infrastructure projects to build capacity. Are we talking about helping stand up entirely new organizations and facilities, or are we talking about supporting and connecting existing organizations and facilities?
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, it's the latter. We're talking about building upon the efforts that exist and strengthening those efforts and providing regional assistance so that anyone else who wants to begin these kinds of services can do so without having to conduct all the research themselves. We really want a base of knowledge that is building in the communities so that people can provide these services in an evidence-based way and track their outcomes. So it is the latter.
Great. That's helpful. Thank you. And I'm really excited. Other questions? Ms. Ames, could you tell us about your report?
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, we just recommend that you acknowledge receipt of the report on the investments.
Madam Chair,
yes.
Move that we acknowledge receipt of the report.
Discussion. Or we accept LFO's recommendation, which motion would you prefer?
Okay.
Motion's been made to acknowledge receipt of the report. Is there discussion on the motion? Objection? Motion passes. Do you want to carry it or shall I?
Your choice, Madam Chair. Happy to do it if you'd like. Happy to have you do it.
I will do it.
Okay.
And I'm closed. Any other business on this work session? No, I'm closing the work session. Okay. We're ready now to move to an informational meeting. Ms. Byerly.
Madam Co-Chair, members of the subcommittee, so this morning I sent you an email last week with a little bit of background on this item. There was a budget note that was included in the end of session budget bill in the 15 session that discussed rate increases that were going out to the ID, some of the IDD providers that were approved in the budget, and wanting some information back from those providers on how those rate increases were being passed along to employees, hopefully in the form of compensation increases. And they're here today to share that information with you. I think we have two provider panels that are kind of come up and talk about what they've been doing, and there's also some written testimony in the system from the providers as well.
Great, thank you. Who's here to testify? Come up. It's my aim to conclude this informational meeting by 10 minutes of 10. That should allow plenty of time for testimony and questions. We might even end earlier. Sometimes we do.
Are you suggesting we don't ask questions?
No, I welcome questions.
Dwayne's gone.
Okay, please introduce yourselves.
Good morning, Representative Nathanson and members of the committee. My name is Gretchen Duby. I'm the Executive Director of Oregon Supported Living Program in Eugene. We provide residential, supported living, and vocational services to adults with intellectual and developmental disabilities in Lane County. We currently employ 205 people in our business, and 185 of which are direct support professionals working directly with the people that we support, all of whom are members of our local workers' union, SEIU. I would like to thank you very much for the 4% that was passed in the last legislative session. However, although it's a step in the right direction, I fear it is not going to be enough to address a really crucial issue of staff retention and turnover in our industry. We used that 4% in January 1st to apply a 75 cent increase to our direct support professionals, which was coupled with a 50 cent increase that OSLP took on ourselves through our operational reserves because of this dire need to raise the wages for our workforce. So with those two raises, our workers received $1.25 in the last 6 months, which is the largest raise they've seen in well over 5 years. I have been with OSLP for 6.5 years and in human services for 25 years, and I have never seen a situation with turnover and staff retention as dire as it is right now in this industry supporting adults with developmental disabilities. 6.5 years ago, when I started as the executive director, we had a turnover rate of 35%, and I've watched that steadily grow to a very scary 49%. I'll tell you, a big reason for this turnover is because of the complexity of the job, literally having people's lives in people's hands regularly and daily, and it is causing quite the difficulty in retaining our staff, because in order to meet the needs of the people we serve, there is some pretty intensive training requirements, and many of the people that we hire don't pass the initial trial service period because of the complexities of those jobs, because it is a entry-level position at this point that requires very little experience. That also tends to support that high turnover rate that we experience. People are just not equipped to deal with what they're faced with on a day-to-day basis, and these rigorous training requirements and the rigorous certifications that are required to do the job do not match the level of experience and qualified staff that are applying for these positions. It not only negatively impacts the business running at overtime costs close to $11,000 or $12,000 a month, $132,000 a year in overtime costs at Oregon Supported Living Program, all of which could be given to the wages of our direct support professionals if we didn't have to manage this constant turnover. It also creates shortages in staffing within our group homes. We have been running about 15 positions short for the last year and a half, which trickles down to the direct impact this has on our clients living within the group homes. Sometimes having 2 to 3 to 4 different caregivers a week, providing very intimate caregiving tasks in their home. And so I ask you to think about if these were your siblings or your children or your parents living in one of our group homes, what that would be like for them receiving intimate care from strangers and care that requires sustaining their life. So that's kind of what the people we support are faced with. And just recently, two of the women that I support in one of our group homes submitted a formal grievance to me asking me why they don't deserve staff who want to stay with them. And so this is starting to impact the people that we support, sometimes having increased behaviors, increased medical needs. One of the women I support has lost all of her hair because of the stress that's involved with different staff coming in and out of her home. It's just a very stressful, compromising situation for them. So although we appreciate your support, I can't impart to you enough the dire situation that we are in, and I'm afraid that although the 4% is a step for us, we require much more in order to sustain professional wages for the workforce that we're having apply. It is crucial for the future of this industry and for the care of our most vulnerable citizens in Lane County. So we appreciate your support, and I ask that you continue to give us more support for the future.
Thank you. It's my plan to hear from all three panelists before we take questions at this panel.
Hi. Good morning, Representative Nathanson and members of the committee. I want to thank you for your time today. My name is Joanne Furman. I'm the co-founder and associate director for Partnerships in Community Living. PCL serves over 300 people in 8 counties, including Jackson, Josephine, Lynn, and Lane. And we employ over 600 direct support professionals who are absolutely essential to the work we do. I want to thank you once again for the 4% rate increase. It was a much-needed relief for the wages for our direct support professionals. PCL has a long history of committing to ongoing wage increases for our valued employees. However, as Gretchen already mentioned, the situation out there right now for us for recruitment and retention of qualified DSPs is dire, and we couldn't wait till January for those increases. So we actually implemented our 4% increases through wages and benefits in July and September of 2015. And we hope that we'll be able to figure out how to do another wage increase into this next fiscal year. We have been able, luckily, to maintain that record of ongoing increases despite our funding increases. However, I want to tell you that after doing that for several years, our reserves are getting so depleted that I'm not sure we'll be able to maintain that. So, like I said, and I'm sure you're going to hear this a lot today, while we appreciate that 4%, it's really just not enough to address the crisis that we're in right now. PCL has over 100 open positions statewide, and that's across our system. And we have positions that have been open for over a year in certain locations for the people we support. So that high turnover rate just means, and our turnover rate's gone up by 10%, what that means is that our staff are working hundreds of hours overtime. Our managers, really everyone throughout our organization, is out there doing the very best we can to provide consistency for the people we support. But most importantly, I mean, our turnover costs last year were $1.5 million. And that's an impact to our organization, but really my concern is the impact to the people we support. Right? I have tired workers working with complicated people, and those costs go up everywhere. That means injury. That means increased medical costs, or, you know, all those things. The trickle impact is just, it's in every part of our organization. You know, we support people with really complex medical needs. We support people with complex challenges. Many people who come to our services, because we have some crisis and stabilization services, have been through up to 20 placements. And they come to us feeling like that failure is theirs. And I want to tell you, it's heartbreaking, because I think the failure is our systems. What people need is a place where they can live, where they can trust that the person who's helping them in the shower isn't going to disappear overnight. That they can establish trusting relationships to deal with all the issues that they need to help figure out how to be, to share their gifts with our community and be real parts of their community. We can't do that without long-term quality staff and without your help. So I really want to leave you with a quote from John F. Kennedy Jr., who is the ideological founder of the National Association of Direct Support Professionals. And he says that quality is defined by the point of interaction between the staff member and that individual with a disability. And that can't be achieved through a revolving door of DSPs. If we want to do right by Argonians with intellectual and developmental disabilities, we have an obligation to provide them with a quality, well-trained workforce who cares about outcomes for them, who will be there the next day. And I would like to ask you to help us continue to do that. Thank you for your time.
Good morning, Co-Chair Nathanson and the committee. A little bit nervous. I don't know why. I'm usually not shy. I don't know what's going on with me. But I'm Pat Allen Sleeman. I'm the Executive Director of Alternative Services Oregon. And we are based in Tigard, our administrative offices, but we provide services to individuals in 8 counties throughout Oregon. We support 140 individuals in 40 licensed 24-hour homes, and we have 5 employment and day support services in those counties supporting 166 individuals. I am also the president of the Oregon Association of Rehabilitation's Board of Directors. Most importantly, I am a parent of a young woman. I prefer to call her young because that makes me not feel so old. She's 37, and she does live in a 24-hour supported group home since she was 23. There were no in-home services when
she was older and needed more support. I made copies of the letters that went out to our staff in September and again in December, talking about the 4% increase that we received as an agency. And depending on the county in the metro area, the staff received a higher wage increase because of the cost of living. But in every county, staff received at least 4%, as high as 21% increase, because we have experienced such a tragic, severe staffing shortage that it is has become dangerous in some situations for us. So we were desperate to try and make sure that people had the supports they needed. We have homes that require 12 and 13 staff, and we would have two. And so people were working a lot of overtime, a lot of homes that they didn't necessarily know the people, because we have to make sure people are safe. The direct care staff that we support, that we employ, appreciated the 4% increase, but then our home managers and our assistant home managers were making less an hour than they were while they were pulling countless shifts, what equated to having well over 100 vacant positions over the last year and a half. Is that many of our staff are now making $18, and I think it was it's over $18 an hour because they're working so much overtime. So it doesn't really pan out or work well for you if you're a salaried position in a group home. With the 4% increase that we did receive from the state, that would equate over an annual period to around $710,000 a year. We gave what will equate on an annual basis $1.5 million in increases, which was approved by our board because we were having such severe staffing shortages, trying to figure out how do we compete to make sure that we can get the staff that's necessary. Like the other providers, we support folks with very complex support needs, medical needs, behavioral support needs. As the board president for the Oregon Rehab Association, in the letter that you have received for my testimony is the information from a survey that we conducted with a lot of our members within the organization. I'm not going to give all that data to you, but essentially it says it came to about over the five-year period that we did the survey, the increase in DD service rates in a five-year period came to 1.06%, which is not a lot when you're talking about working with individuals who have complex needs. As a parent, I think we all want our children to be safe and happy and secure, whether they're adults or children. And our consumers face, on a daily basis, strangers, just as you've heard, doing their personal care, helping them with their meals, taking them into the community. For my daughter, it's very sad because she is so upset when staff change and leave because she becomes attached to them that we've had to place Amy on psychotropic medication for anxiety. The other result of when we are down staff is that I've had to send people to a state-operated program because we cannot staff people safely. Those programs cost twice as much a month than their community placements. So they're in a community near their families. We just sent a young woman who I have served for 10 years. She's 22 years old. And she had to go to a state-operated program a couple weeks ago because the level of staff that she requires to be safe, we absolutely could not hire and retain. We are drowning as providers. We cannot compete. And people aren't failing because we don't want them to be successful. We're failing because we can't get staff. I appreciate you listening today. You have any questions?
Thank you very much, all three of you, for your testimony. I have several questions I want to start out with. I started writing these questions during Ms. Doobie's testimony. You may want to respond, or someone else may want to. With regard to the 75% increase, and then added into that, I think you had to, you supplemented that with another 50 cents from your reserve, I think you said.
Correct.
So that's an the increase per hour. About how many hours is someone working a week?
Well, typically we schedule a direct support worker for a 40-hour per week schedule. Recently, we've been hiring and scheduling people for about 30 to 35 so that there's room for the shifts that they have to cover without attaining such a high overtime cost. But I would say, on average, 60 hours a week for a direct support professional with all of the overtime that they're having to pick up.
Which is alarming. When we had testimony last year, many of us on this committee, and Co-Chair Bates and I both were very concerned about turnover. I'm also concerned about getting tired.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
When you're tired, you increase risk to yourself and the person that you're taking care of, and increase the chance for becoming sick. I'm very concerned about both turnover and a very large amount of overtime, not just the occasional overtime.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It's almost as if you have to plan in a regular large amount of overtime to add on. So that that causes me to ask you, you're 15 positions short. Someone else mentioned 100 statewide. There must be business managers or business consultants who tell you what that tipping point is. If you would raise the wage, it's probably mostly about the wage and not other conditions, because it is the circumstances of the job that it's a very hard job. There may be some other things you could do to help support the person in the job, but thinking just about the wage, what's the tipping point where you start to make a real impact in both hiring and retaining so that you don't have the turnover? For example, you've just recently increased the wage. How soon will you know, 3 months or 6 months or 9 months, whether that is starting to reverse that trend and turnover? How long do we wait to see?
Well, you know, I really wish I could answer that question, because it would help me plan for my business a little more effectively. I would like to think that we're going to see an almost immediate response, and at the very least, the number of people applying for positions. I think it's very difficult when there is high competition in the community for the same types of jobs and a different model of service that make it a very competitive workforce. There's not a whole lot of professionals in our community that are caring for people with such complex needs, and those workers are torn between other positions that are available in the community that maybe pay 50 cents to $2 more an hour, and so that makes it difficult. I can say for OSLP individually, the number of people applying does not necessarily reflect the quality of people applying. And so we scrutinize our workers pretty highly. We have some pretty rigorous requirements to just attain the job, let alone retain the job. And so that's really the most telling factor, is the quality of people applying, and can they do the job and sustain it.
Representative Nathan and members of the committee, I might be able to help a little bit with that. We've actually done some studies where, because we're in various parts of the state, where we've increased wages at different places to track data, trying to get to that magic number. We've tried several different things, and we've gone up to $1.50 an hour change, and after a year and a half of that in Southern Oregon, actually found no impact. We, in our valley, up in the valley, we did $1 an hour, and again, after a year. So we've kept data and seen that that really hasn't made any impact on our retention and turnover. Our retention is pretty good. It's around getting people through the door. And what I find, I think you're absolutely right, people don't leave PCL. They don't leave the people we support because of wages. They leave because they have to provide for their family. So in our exit interviews, which we keep data on exit interviews, what we hear is, I wish I could stay. I love this job. I love the people that I work with. They like our company. But they can go work doing virtually the same work in different parts of our system and start at upwards of $15 an hour. So without any real data to tell you, because I haven't tried that because we can't afford it, I would tell you that we at least have to be competitive. We at least have to pay as much as what people can make in other parts of our system doing very similar work. That would be a starting point. But I don't have, we have looked into all kinds of data, and I can't find really a magic number, but I can tell you what we've done has not had any impact.
And if I might add, too, I think it's important to note that out of my 205 employees, 90% of them receive government assistance in order to provide for their families. So we're talking about people who are barely making it paycheck to paycheck. And I sign multiple draws every other week for people who just can't do that. It's a very sad statistic when you look at the number of employees who have a 40-plus hour week job and still need government assistance to provide for themselves.
Representative Nathan in the committee, I do keep data, and since July, we have paid as an organization $713,000 in overtime, which, you know, you can imagine when you're budgeted for $11.24 an hour to pay staff. And with the high turnover, over 50% of my employees have been with us less than a year. And I think as an agency, if you make the decision to support people who have very complex needs, it's even more difficult to find staff that are willing to do those supports and go through the amount of training and the expectations that we have so that people are safe. We normally will say to an employee, you cannot work more than 16 hours a day. It's not safe. But if they do that, and we have some employees who have worked 16 hours a day, 7 days a week for 7 months, you begin to worry about whether they're making good decisions.
Mm-hmm. Could you remind me, $713,000 since when?
Since July. Since the beginning of the fiscal year.
Not even a whole year.
No. It'll be over $1 million by the time the year ends.
Thank you. Senator Devlin.
Basically a question for all the parties at the table. The House co-chair and I have struggled with this issue for a number of years. One of the things, though, that we've talked about is, if I would compare you to particularly the long-term care industry, particularly the nursing home side, that is pretty much an open books industry, meaning we know exactly all of their expenditures, we know all of their costs, and also, in a sense, there's a second issue here, not only open books, but one of the issues that we've talked about in terms of this particular issue is that we utilize an assumed an assumed hourly rate for employees. We don't actually, in any sense, prescribe a minimum hourly rate for employees. So what is your reaction to both of those, of us actually asking for a more open books policy in terms of we would want to know exactly how things are being managed in a sense of the costs, and the second of us prescribing what the minimum wage is if we're to actually fund a minimum wage for this type of care?
Senator Devlin, I can take a shot at that first. I would be happy to have any of you look at our accounting of where the money is spent for both our employees and the support services for the people that we do have in our homes and employment programs. And the expenses that just come along with running a business. I think that in terms of subscribing a particular wage, I think based on how we are funded now, there is sort of an expectation of a minimum amount that you should be paying your staff, which is was $10.80 plus some room for benefits. And so when the 4% increase was given, it's still, we cannot compete in this system when we're paying people $11.24 or anywhere near that, when other people in the system are making much higher wages, and we lose staff because they're making much higher wages.
Senator Devlin, if I could take a shot at that as well for the committee. I actually would be happy to, if you'd like further information on some breakdown of what our budget looks like, I'd be happy to share that with the committee as far as where resources go and how they're spent. And to your question around a prescribed rate, I think we have in our rate model, we have an assumed rate that really has to be an average rate. I mean, you have to say, I need to be able to compensate my 15 and 16-year employees higher than that rate in our budget model. So really what happens effectively in the community is we have to start a little bit under that so that when we do our budget, which like I said, we could do another time, I can explain to you, that it all comes out, that we have enough funds and resources to pay someone who's worked with me. And I have employees who've worked with our organization since we've started. So I have 25-year direct support professionals. So I have to be able to pay them and the others. So it's a little bit more complicated than that. But I mean, if it meant that the people that we, that our DSPs who are so valuable to us could make a living wage, then, and you want to give me, you know, you want to put in our rates $15, $16 an hour, I'm telling you, I will come here and show you how I do it every single session.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, I welcome the same opportunity. I know for myself, I still consider myself a fairly new executive director to considering the pioneers in our field behind me. However, I was shocked as a new executive director what's involved above and beyond the state funding for running this business. There are, you know, 18 group homes. We have 18 vehicles, 18 managers, program directors, training costs that are in addition to what's the basic requirements, unemployment, injuries. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. And then when you add full benefits at no cost to the employee, it adds up very quickly. My staff were shocked to know that when I first started, I was warned against an $1,000 or $2,000 a month overtime costs, and now we're not so shocked at $10,000 a month overtime. And so I think to really hone in on the extra numbers involved above and beyond state funding is astonishing.
Thank
Madam
you.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
I might follow up. Thank you for the responses. I think the committee is aware of this, but and it wasn't any issue with the providers, but we requested a couple of times, and finally we were able to get through a budget note some fair information on actually the number of workers involved in this. I mean, it's like an unknown area. We know how many state employees we have, but actually the numbers are rather staggering in terms of the number of lower income contracted workers we have through nonprofit entities that are dependent upon state funding. Whatever minimum wage proposal that we ultimately approve will have a long-term impact on those costs. So,
yeah. Thank you. Thank you all for your testimony. I think we need to move on now to the next
thank
panel.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for being here today. Okay, the other panel. I'm going to assume that each of you also has a prepared statement of about 3 or 4 minutes, and then we'll take questions after you speak. Go ahead and begin.
Yes. Hello, dear co-chair Nathanson and members of the committee. My name is Anna Keenan-Mudrick. I'm the Executive Director of Community Access Services, a nonprofit organization that supports individuals with IDD and primarily in Columbia, Washington, Multnomah, and Clackamas counties. We've just started helping out and providing some supported employment services in Hood River and Wasco, very new there, but excited to be able to help out. So wanted to first start off by extending my sincere gratitude for the 4% increase that you provided to many of our rates, to our comprehensive rates. It covers most of the services that Community Access Services provides. We do provide a couple of other service elements that were not impacted by this, but this was really hitting our most dire rate needs. So really appreciate the targeted focus of that. So as you've been hearing, and I don't want to be redundant, but it's really want to emphasize that it is really a tremendous struggle that we all have that we're trying to manage and work through, and that is that with our current rate structure and without having cost of living increases since about 2008, including, you know, and I've, as you can see in the handouts, if you have them in front of you, understanding that I'm rather verbose and I know this about me, and I also have a pretty lengthy testimony. It's true. We all know it. These guys don't. I've also provided a table, some tables, to try to help provide some clarity because that might be simpler and it's kind of complex. And you'll see that the way that we've implemented actually our rate increases is also not. It's also fairly complex because we took a really thorough look at our entire rate structure for our DSPs and tried to figure out where to put in a little bit more to make greater impact and to provide more equity internally in our organization. So I do apologize for how complex this looks, but I want you to know it came with a lot of thought and you know, being the good nerd that I am, I overthought the heck out of it. And I'm still working internally with my staff to figure out how do we do better and do more from here. So more to come on that, but I'm hoping that the tables I provided also provide some clarity and where we went with this. At any rate, I'll also walk through it verbally, but just know that you've got that attachment as well to help provide some clarity if it seems too confusing. So again, understanding that with the beautiful increase in the economy, things are starting to rejuvenate, combined with the fact that we've struggled again with no cost of living increase for quite some time, then had a 6% rate cut actually for 3 years pretty recently, that thanks to you guys that was restored a couple of years ago, and appreciate that, but it still was a pretty good hit there for a while, made it extra difficult, and of course with the budget assumption we've had for some time based on an average of $10.80 an hour. Many of us have tried to get creative with how we make increases, but it is challenging to figure it out at the end of the day and not put our organizations at risk when that is what is built into our rate model. So always having to manage that. All the staff who are providing supports, again, do some very personal care, including I wanted to list some of the nurse delegated tasks as well, and not everyone we serve has intensive medical support needs, but quite a few do. And, you know, so when you think of a direct support professional, you may not realize some of the very, very personal things they do beyond just, of course, the obvious very personal things of helping support someone and getting dressed and bathing and using the restroom, things like that, but also tube feeding, catheter care, light suctioning, insulin, glucose monitoring. So, I mean, these are just a handful of things that the executive director can come up with. My staff could probably give you a much lengthier list. We also do things, as was described earlier, providing positive behavioral supports to individuals we serve, some of whom have some pretty intensive support needs and are can really hurt themselves when we're not helping provide them with some very personal, sometimes sadly, necessarily intrusive support. And we try to minimize how intrusive that is, but that's also complex. You know, making sure our staff understand and how to really minimize the need for anything that is intrusive. But reality is that sometimes in order to keep people from breaking bones or gouging their eyes out, and those are real examples, you know, sometimes we need to get a little more involved. But I raise this only because I want to explain some of the complexities of the supports that are provided. And from there, I think I will just go ahead and just try to give you a quick rundown then of how we've utilized the increase, because I'm sure I've gone beyond 3 minutes, sorry. I've done this in multiple phases. So in phase one, you'll see actually, and I include this because this is a small impact on our overall budget, but it was an important decision that we made. Back in 2014, we decided to add in something that was not in our traditional comprehensive service system, so not touched by this increase, but something that's growing in our field, thankfully, in-home supports. So supporting individuals we serve to live in their own homes and their own communities. So when we added that in, we recognized we'd need to hire staff, of course, who not only were able to do the wonderful things our staff already do, but were able to do so with very little supervision or support, and also be able to work, you know, very autonomously, really high problem-solving skills. We have to be fairly sophisticated in that. And then the documentation required as well is pretty complex. And we have to do a lot of rewriting and all of that good stuff because, you know, need to ensure that that we're satisfying Medicaid and all of that. So we decided to pay that workforce $13.75 an hour to start. As we were, and by the way, that does significantly increase the pool we found, so that's been a bit of an inadvertent experiment as well, but it's still, it can be challenging at that rate. So, there we go. Huh. I can be so verbose, as I said earlier, so I'm trying to think of how to succinctly wrap this up. Essentially, we decided that in our supported living services that were one of our comprehensive service systems that were impacted by the 4% after this time, of course, we decided that that because they were doing such similar work, we needed to be equitable with how we were paying staff in the supported living department. So we actually put them under the same umbrella. We increased by 20% the rates for our supported living professionals at that time, and that was just at the time impacted just a couple of people, but since then we've grown that department, it's impacted more. So we first made that internal decision earlier at the very beginning of last year to increase our DSPs, our supported living DSPs, to an average wage of $14.25 an hour now, because they've both been with us for 2 years. So phase two, one of the other things that we've been working on for quite some time is wanting to have equity and parity with our staff who are in rural areas and in our metro area. So what we ended up doing is once we knew with certainty that we were going to be getting the 4%, we decided to increase our Columbia County DSPs. And I know that that might seem, you know, I'm listening to the different minimum wage proposals and understand that there's a higher one that is proposed for the metro area. But one of the things that we're finding and are sensitive to with our staff we support rurally, and of course something to consider, is that they also have increased expenses in having to travel further to get medical attention, to do different shopping, things like that. Transportation is even more of a challenge. So we've been talking internally the last couple of years about bringing our Columbia County DSPs to parity. So we did that back in September, September 1st of last year. So at that time, it was between a 2.2 and a 4.4% increase to that group of DSPs. And we also raised our start rate to $11 an hour at that time across the board, so we're not going to pay anyone less than that. So it did also provide an increase to some of our Portland metro area staff who received then a 2.3% increase. So phase three. As of January 1st, most recently, so we're getting up to the most current now, we provided an immediate increase on top of the other increases I've described of between 2.2 and 4.4%. Again, that's immediate. And part of what we've done then is we've built in an additional quarter increase after someone has been with us for a year. That we're hoping that helps bias some incentive for retention. But also that you know, still honors, of course, the overall intention with the 4% increase, because it provides a 4.4% increase by no later than January 1st of 2017 for every single DSP we support at a minimum. Again, explaining, you know, I've explained earlier on that some of them have received more than that. And that goes beyond our existing increase schedule. So when we first hire someone, so right now at $11.25 an hour is our DSP starting rate. Then we raise them to $11.50 at 6 months, then to $11.75 at 1 year, and to $12 an hour after 2 years. So we already had some increased structure internally in place that we do. This added an additional step at the 1 year point. It was a quarter at 6 months, a quarter at the 2 year point. So it added an additional step in there. And thank you so much for the ability to do that. We also looked at our lead DSPs and did something a little bit differently with them, provided them an additional increase because we recognize that more and more they're having to take on more responsibility with our increased turnover and all of that. So we provided an additional, on top of the increase I've just described, additional increase of between 25 cents and 75 cents an hour. And then in looking at understanding that, of course, this still doesn't touch many of our very underpaid positions, like our group home supervisors, and of course our other significant administrative and senior leadership positions. But the priority, of course, is our DSPs, where we have focused this. And then we also did increase our frontline supervisors, our group home and day support program managers, by the equivalent of about a quarter an hour. Understanding, of course, they're not hourly employees, but by $520 annually, which is a little bit, and we know it's not enough, but we felt we needed to add something in there, so we were able to figure that out, and with promise to our supervisors that as we roll this out, that we are committed to finding other ways to increasing them. We've just not figured it quite out yet. We've got to be responsible, figure it out as we go. We also, although this rate increase was for our, of course, impacted the comprehensive part of our system, group homes, day programs, and employment, we also, though, added the additional quarter step increase for our direct support professional positions that were more specialized, the ones I was talking about earlier in in-home supports. We've also added job coaching as we've been developing supported employment to that category, that same rate structure. So we added an additional quarter increase at the one-year point for them as well, so that would be good and consistent and provide them with that nice bump. So that is the nutshell version, like the lengthy version. And again, as I talked about, having to figure out other critical positions, and one other one I'd like to highlight are our nurse staff that aren't included in this, of course, but just as an aside, it's becoming all the more challenging to recruit nurses. So one of the things we've done internally over the last year and formally is, as we've needed to recruit RNs, we have gone outside of our what we've had as our established rate structure for RNs and have negotiated beyond that because we've had to bring people in. Otherwise, we can't compete. And then for our LPNs, it's been a real struggle, and we're working internally very diligently on how to figure out how to make an effective increase to our LPN salary as well, or rate, hourly rate.
I need to make sure that we have time for the rest of the testimony.
Yes, I'm sorry. So thank you very much for all of your time and attention. Thank you.
And I'm going to ask the LFO staff to please note that I'm going to have a financial, it's sort of like a fiscal analysis question on page 5 of this testimony, mm-hmm. where it's the COLAs dating back from 1982-83. It's a very succinct summary. I'm going to want to follow up with you on what that means. There was a 6% cut, then a 6% mm-hmm. restored, but when you have all zeros in between,
rates were flat.
Well, not only rates were flat, but
costs were not.
If you take cost of living from that point, 2008-09, what happened as far as backsliding. So I'm going to want to follow up with you later. Next testimony.
Co-Chair Nathanson, members of the committee. My name is Brian Farley. I'm the executive director for Sunny Oaks Incorporated. We're a smaller agency. We're in two counties. And thank you very much for the 4%. We utilized it right away. We were able to raise wages by 6 to 7% for our direct care staff. They need it. We love them. We want to take good care of them. The better care we take of them, the better care they take care of the people we support with disabilities. We were able to go from $10.25 an hour for starting wages to $11 an hour. And we went from an average of $11.13 to an average of $11.91 per hour. And we're experiencing some of the same issues that the other providers are experiencing as well. So thank you very much for the 4%.
Good morning, Co-Chair Nathanson and members of the committee. I'm Carl Acali. I'm the Chief Operations Officer with Renew Consulting. We're based in Albany, Oregon, and we provide services in 17 homes in 9 different counties. And we, too, are very appreciative and thankful for the 4% increase, as you've heard from all the agencies. And today we want to just quickly demonstrate how it was implemented as an information for all of you. We started out we raised our starting wage to $10.50, and then in certain areas where we're seeing recruitment issues, we are giving a 50-cent differential so that some of those individuals are starting at $11 an hour. Then we also, in certain or in all the areas, have raised our cap to $12.50 an hour. We are relatively a younger agency. We are not quite 12 years old yet, as many of these agencies have been around a lot longer than we have. And our cap is not as high. I don't think we have a DSP that's been with us that long. Many of them have moved up into management, which is always one of our goals as well. If they do decide to pursue management, that we give them every opportunity to do so. After much negotiation with medical costs the way that they were, our medical costs were going to increase 8%, which was a pretty significant increase. But with much negotiations, many meetings, we were able to get that down to 2%. But with the 4% increase, our wage increase was about 5% plus the 2% medical cost. I think the challenges for the future, as we've heard many of us speak to, will be the minimum wage. There has to be a gap between the two to be able to maintain and sustain our DSPs and keep them motivated. The 4% raised morale. It was exciting to be able to see their faces, to hear their expressions, to hear their words coming back, and so appreciative of that. They've heard several conversations throughout the last couple of years, the fight we're going on or what we're trying to do at the Capitol. And so they were extremely appreciative. The emails are flying in daily on what that meant to them, and we're hoping that that continues on. The sad but true fact is some folks that do leave said, why have such a high demanding job when I can make the same at a coffee shop? And I truly understand that and get that for them. We are struggling to recruit in certain areas, but yet other areas are right now really blossoming. I'm not sure how long we're going to be able to watch the data to be able to say, oh, this is the positive side effects. I think it is maybe 3 months, 6 months, a year to see what goes on with that. But we have also had struggles opening new homes because of the wage and where it was. Our turnover rate last year was 40%, whereas some weeks we were paying overtime anywhere from 300 hours to 800 hours company-wide of overtime. Which is a large amount of funds. Even though you have to pay somebody to work that, the overtime does cost quite a bit for each agency. We are hoping to curtail that turnover rate with the increases in what we're going to see in the future. Other things we're discussing is we are trying to implement a 401k plan. We do not offer that at this time for our DSPs, but that's what we're working towards, as well as other benefits that would be increased PTO for them, so that we can be not only competitive with other agencies, but we want to be competitive with other companies of all fashions, because we do feel like we're taking care of the greatest people group in the world, folks with intellectual development disabilities. Thank you again for your time and all your efforts and everything that all of you do. And I would love to give any tours to any of you that would love to go to some of our homes and see who we serve. Thank you again.
Thank you very much. So I'm wondering, to compete with the coffee shop, is the coffee shop offering access to a 401k?
Not the ones I've checked.
Some are.
Starbucks. Maybe some of them are.
Some are offering free tuition.
Yeah. We're trying.
Questions for this panel?
I have one,
Mr. Borley, and are you experiencing turnover issues as well?
We are not to the degree that I've been hearing today, but we do have them, and ours stays around the 25-30% range, but we're a smaller company, and we're not taking on some of the really challenging situations that, say, PCL or ASI or CAS are taking on. So I think that's part of the situation. We've been around for a really long time, since 1973, so our systems are in place, and we do have employees that have been there for 15, 20, 26 years. So we are experiencing the turnover. We've done a lot of work. We've brought in some professionals to try and help us reduce that, and it's been somewhat effective. And again, we're in two counties, smaller areas, so we can connect in different ways.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes, Representative.
I just want to make a comment. I really want to thank both panels. And I remember the person who came, who was a personal support worker, a guy who had worked there about 20 years, and he was making $11.20. And he said, I love this work. I'm so passionate about the people I serve, and I can't not even support my family. So that has really stuck with me as what you've said today. And I do find this chart quite amazing to see a 4% increase over the last 6 years. Yeah. It's really shocking. So thank you so much for bringing that home again.
Any other questions for this panel? Yes, Representative.
Thank you, Co-Chair. Hi. On that, it actually just reminded me just a statement. I sympathize with the wages that people are earning for this hard work. Roughly 15 years ago, when I was a direct support provider, and working the long hours, would sometimes work through the night. Somebody might call in, so then you work the day shift as well, and you're just exhausted. And when I finally threw in the towel on that, I left there and went and made, I think, $1.25 an hour more in a call center. Mm-hmm. And it was, I remember sitting there going, I liked the work I was doing, but the comparison, it was just easier to work somewhere else. Mm-hmm. So keep it up.
Thank you. We'll try to be creative as much as we possibly can.
Thank you all for coming to be with us today, for providing testimony that was very responsive to the question we asked. I really appreciate the work you do for Oregonians.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We're adjourned.
Sure. Sure.